Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor LeCain. As part of our focus on solutions, we bring you some of the most creative people who are developing ideas and programs that can dramatically improve our lives and our country. Today's guest is one of the most creative and influential thought leaders in the United States. She has helped shape foreign policy and national security at the highest levels. And she has spoken honestly about the challenges of balancing work and family life in ways that help spawn a renewed national debate on the continued obstacles to genuine full male-female equality. Anne-Marie Slaughter is the president and CEO of New America, a think tank and civic enterprise with offices in Washington, D.C. and New York. She is also Professor Emerita of Politics and International Affairs at Princeton University. From 2009 to 2011, she served as Director of Policy Planning at the U.S. Department of State, the first woman to hold that powerful position. After leaving the Department of State, Dr. Slaughter published the article, Why Women Still Can't Have It All, in The Atlantic, which quickly became the most read article in the history of the magazine and which sparked a vigorous national debate on work-life balance and gender equality. Prior to her government service, Dr. Slaughter was the Dean of Princeton's Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs and a professor of international, foreign, and comparative law at Harvard Law School. Dr. Slaughter has written or edited 7 books and over 100 scholarly articles. Her groundbreaking new book, Unfinished Business, Women, Men, Work, and Family, shows a pathway to gender equality. She was the convener and academic co-chair of the Princeton Project on National Security, a multi-year research project aimed at developing a new bipartisan national security strategy for the United States. Foreign Policy Magazine named Dr. Slaughter to their list of the top 100 global thinkers. She received a BA from Princeton, an MPhil and DPhil in international relations from Oxford, and a law degree from Harvard. She is married to Professor Andrew Moravcik. They live in Princeton with their 2 sons. Dr. Slaughter provides frequent commentary for both mainstream and new media and will be here with us shortly today. Dr. Slaughter, are you there?
I am. I'm delighted to be here.
Fantastic. I'm thrilled you're here. I so appreciate you taking the time, and I don't know if you heard the beginning of the show, but I called you one of the most creative and influential thought leaders in the United States today.
I did. I was honored.
Fantastic. I think you're awesome, and there's so much. I wish we had 5 hours to talk, but we just have one, but I treasure that time. I'd like to focus our conversation today on work-life balance and
yes.
The article wrote and the book, which I think is just so important. And I actually think it's one of the most important books I've read in my life, your most recent book on unfinished business. So
thank you.
let's start with this. You know, you wrote that article in The Atlantic, Why Women Still Can't Have It All, when you left your high-level position at State. And you explained in the article that you left the job so you could have more time with your husband and 2 sons. Why did you decide to write that article and to give the whole truth about why you left, including that you wanted to pay more attention to your family?
Well, I decided to write the article first, because I realized that essentially what I'd believed and been saying for decades was incomplete, let's put it that way. Where, so as a professor, as a dean even, I had been telling younger women who always ask me, you know, how do you fit your work and your life together? And I would essentially say a version of Lean In. I would say, look, you know, you just make it work. That would be my response always. If you're committed enough to your career, you make it work. And when I got to Washington and, you know, I had a great boss. I had a husband who was willing to be the lead parent in Princeton 5 days a week because I left Monday morning and came back Friday evening. I had money. I had the ability to hire help. I had every advantage. And I was plenty committed to my career. I wouldn't have been commuting like that if I hadn't been. And yet the elder of our two sons was in middle school, 13, 14. Many parents will understand what can go wrong at that age. And he really was heading in the wrong direction. And I realized after 2 years that even though I could stay and be promoted and then the jobs that were above me were just completely amazing jobs. I mean, it's really the very top of foreign policy. I realized I had to make a choice. And so once I realized that, I started thinking very differently about all the women who I knew who had made a similar choice, and I honestly had not appreciated it before. I had, if anything, thought, well, I guess they're not that committed to their career. And now I was rethinking that. So that was I felt like, well, if my thinking's changed, maybe I should write about that. And then what really decided me to do it was talking to a lot of younger women after I came out from the State Department. And when I would talk about the reality of my experience, I essentially got the reaction from younger women saying, thank goodness you didn't just give us, you can have it all, just try hard. You know, in other words, they clearly wanted to hear a more honest account. And so that, you know, I'm a professor, I was, and that sense of teaching or sharing your knowledge with younger people is, to me, kind of an imperative, and that's really what made me decide to do it. I, of course, did not anticipate the reaction.
And what a reaction it was. I remember seeing you all over the place. You were on the radio.
Yes.
You were being interviewed by magazines, on television.
Yes.
It was really, you really struck a nerve with that piece in The Atlantic. And I'm so happy that with all the response you got, you decided to write a book about it, and that's this book, Unfinished Business. I was also struck that you wrote with both really good research and great, you know, case studies and examples, and you also wrote in a deeply personal way. And you talk about your own gender bias towards men as caregivers, your pain in leaving your sons as you went to work in a different city, and about your teenage son who you just mentioned having running into some difficulties and even run-ins with the police. Now, that level of deep personal sharing is very unusual for someone active in Washington, D.C. circles where people are so careful about managing their image. How did you have the courage to be so personally revealing?
Well, it wasn't easy, although I will say that I think I'm not your classic Washington person in that regard. You know, I've spent my life more in the academy where people are not so careful to cultivate the perfect persona the way they are in politics. But I also felt that I have privilege and a platform that others don't. And so, you know, if I'm honest, much less will happen to me, knock wood, than many, many, many millions of women who either they really cannot tell the truth because somebody will strike back at them at work or they'll be seen differently in their community, or they simply don't have the platform I was given. And I did not want to write a book. I had no intention of writing a book. In fact, I told my agent the week before the article came out, look, no matter what happens, and again, none of us imagined that it was going to have the impact it did, but I said, I'm writing a foreign policy book. I'm not going to turn this into a book because I already thought, well, he's my agent. That's what his job is, to try to get me to write books. But then so many people wrote to me just hundreds and hundreds of letters and emails, and then, of course, thousands of blog posts. And I thought, these stories are so powerful, and I've been handed this platform by virtue of the article, and so writing this book is not just about me, it's about giving voice to people who don't have voice. And then I figured if I'm going to write this book, it can't be a kind of policy book or an academic book. The only reason to write it is to reach as broad an audience as possible. And for that, yes, I've got to be willing to open the books on my own life. And of course, you know, with my son, he's now a freshman in a very good university, and he's turned around. And he gave me permission to share parts of his story on the theory that this would be more real to people and maybe have more impact.
That's tremendous. I so appreciate that you did. I think the fact that you spoke so from the heart and so honestly about your own experience really made a very powerful book. Now, I'm tempted to ask you, since you wrote the article and then had the hundreds and thousands of responses and all the deliberation you went to, I know you wrote the book, which I love the book, and I encourage our listeners to read Unfinished Business, but would you write that article differently today, or would you just give it a new title?
Well, I'd certainly give it a new title, although I say in the book, and it's true, that the accurate title would be, you know, How to Change the Workplace and National Policy So That Women Can Stay in the Pool and Make It to the Top. That's not a very catchy title. And so I have to say that the Atlantic probably knew what it was doing. You know, it's hard to look back. One of the things that is so striking is I could not have written the book I've just written 3 years ago. I mean, the book Unfinished Business talks about valuing care and changing the roles of men. That's not what I thought 3 years ago, you know, when I was writing the article in 2011 and 2012. I still saw this almost entirely as a woman's issue, and I still thought, well, this is really about, you know, making changes in the office, and I still believe that. But I now have come to really think, wait a minute, we have a deeply unfinished revolution. That's why it's called Unfinished Business. You know, that we've liberated women to do the work our fathers did, but along the way we devalued the work our mothers have always done, both for women, but of course then also for men, and that just won't work. You have to understand that investing in families, investing in others and people you love, people you care for, whether they're biologically your family or your community or your students or your employees, that kind of investing in others is just as important as, you know, the kind of investing in yourself and advancing your own career and earning a lot of money. And that's a much bigger social revolution. So I couldn't have gotten to where I am now if I didn't start where I'd been. So I don't know if I can't really imagine writing a different article.
Yeah, well, I think you wrote the book, and you brought us on the book into the deep inquiry that you went in with the challenges, you know, including some of the critiques around what about women with less education and lower income, and your own deep inquiry, and you bring us on that journey with you, which I so appreciate. And I really love, you talk about the modern feminist movement as one of the great struggles for human freedom of the 20th century. And I just love that description of the women's movement, because I feel that way about, I shouldn't say women's movement, it's a feminist movement, because men
right.
can be feminists too. So, and you're so right. You talk about there was a strong focus in the modern women's movement on encouraging women to enter the workforce and earn their own livelihood, to earn respect and economic independence, which women have done very successfully, both because of choice and necessity economically.
Right.
But then as women got into the workforce came the issue, who is taking care of the children the women are working? And that has fallen largely on women. It's not that they, you know, stopped caring for families and started working. They sort
exactly.
of took on a second job.
Yes.
So I notice in you talk about that you began to question the feminist narrative that success meant career achievement and that women could have it all, you know, work and family like men do. So I'd appreciate it if you could talk a little bit about what that journey was for you to question that feminist narrative and where it brought you.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you asked the question that way, because this is one of the things that I write that often gets misunderstood. So I'm happy to try to explain exactly what I meant, which is, you know, the feminist narrative I grew up with was, yes, you can be just like men. You can have a career and a family too. And it's perfectly possible, and you just have to, you know, as I said, want it hard enough, be committed enough to your career. And I still think, I think essentially that all human beings, women and men, the vast majority of us would like to have both. In other words, we want to have work that we do that is, gives us independence, if we're lucky, is meaningful to us and valuable to us. And we also want to be surrounded by those we love and have a chance to be with those people. And again, that can be a biological family or a constructed family, or in some cases people find that in their community. And so I think all human beings want both. What changed, and what I now think, what really changed in my narrative was that the kind of what I grew up with was what matters is the work. And the family piece, well, that gets fit in kind of around it, or you balance it, or you whatever, but it's really the work is the most important thing, and everything else comes second. And that's why when women say, I'm working part-time, or I'm not working, if they have the luxury of not working, to take care of my family, they're just devalued. I mean, you know, in Washington, if you say that, somebody looks over your shoulder and finds someone else to talk to at a cocktail party. And what's changed is I now say, wait a minute, that work is just as important as the work you were doing as a reporter or a receptionist or whatever else it was, just because you're not getting paid for it in money, but the value of it to both you and to your children and to our society is enormous. And that is, I did not grow up with that. I grew up with, you know, everything domestic is devalued. And I understand why, because we didn't want to confirm the stereotypes of women as, you know, the child rearers, the nurturers. We wanted to prove that women could be just as competitive as men and could outpace them. And now I'm saying, well, yeah, but actually that other role is just as important. And here's the kicker, it's just as important for men. Because if we just say it's just as important and it's women's job, then we'll go backwards. But if we say it's just as important and that means we should expect men to do it just as much as we expect women to do it, then we get to real equality.
Right. I love that you're doing this, and that the whole framing of the importance of valuing caregiving as much as breadwinning. I think you just really nailed where we need to go, kind of at the next level of the feminist movement. One of the other stories of books that was out there around the same time is Sheryl Sandberg, whose book Lean In really also made a splash. And in that, she focuses on the piece you mentioned where women were encouraged to get out there in the workforce and to be competitive. And so Sandberg's talking about leaning in and getting women to climb into the executive suite, into a traditional male world. Whereas you're saying, yes, we can encourage women to be strong and to be competitive in whatever arena they choose, but at the same time, let's recognize that the set of corporate hierarchies that women are trying to climb into, that system itself is antiquated and broken. What do you see as some of the broader systemic changes that need to happen beyond women pushing themselves to higher levels?
I should say I admire Sheryl Sandberg. I admire what she's done. And it hasn't been without risk herself. I mean, as she writes in Lean In, people told her, oh, don't get involved in this kind of stuff, you know, precisely because you're on the fast corporate track. You're the COO of Facebook. You've worked at the Treasury, all those things. Even though she focuses on a different part of it than I do, it was a courageous thing to do, and she's made a lot of difference for a lot of women. But my critique is that that corporate world that we're supposed to be leaning into is a world that was designed for an economy that is 50 years out of date, or at least 30 years out of date. That corporate world, the C-suites of America, still assume you've got a full-time caregiver at home if you have a family. There are no male CEOs. No male CEOs, period, the end, other than perhaps men who are in same-sex couples, but even no male CEOs, I would say, who also have primary responsibility for their house, for their home and their kids, if they have families. And so the whole corporate structure assumes that there is one primary breadwinner and there's one primary caregiver, and guess what? That's overwhelmingly, men who are there and women with full-time wives at home. And my point is, no. In the first place, in many ways, that entire structure of the economy, these big hierarchical corporations, those are not going to be the major engines of economic growth in this century. And they're certainly not going to be if they don't make room for all their workers, women and men, to take care of their children and of their parents and of each other. And so I just want much more sweeping change, because, what often happens is women who make it into the C-suite under that system, they can change the system around the edges. They can provide for paternity leave, and they can, be more sensitive to what women need. But they're not going to make that kind of sweeping change, as I said, that says, no, this isn't about women. This is about all workers, and this is about everybody having time to be engaged with your kids when they're young and your parents when they're old. And in between those times, you can work really hard and you make, climb up to positions where you don't have time, lower, much less time for family. But we're going to make it possible over the whole span of your career, to assume, as I said, that men and women have care responsibilities as well as work responsibilities.
I think that's beautifully said, and I do agree we need sweeping change. I would say not only in the corporate area, in the C-suite, but also in government and nonprofit
yes.
jobs, where people are often in very demanding roles equally. And I do think there are just some jobs where when you are in that position, you must have someone else as the full-time
yes.
caregiver at home. I mean, for
yes.
extreme example, the President of the United States, whether that's a male or a female, if you're the President,
yes.
your spouse needs to be totally devoted to supporting
yep.
you in that role so you
Completely.
Can do that role. And I think, whether it's Barack Obama who's the President and Michelle is the support, or if Michelle were the President, then Barack would need to
exactly.
be there supporting her. So there
exactly.
are some very demanding roles. And I think that was the role you had as Director of Policy Planning in Department of State. That's one of those jobs where it's a 24/7 job, and that's got to be what you're doing. Would you agree?
I would, and you're absolutely right. That was my point in part about we don't expect male CEOs to also run their household, and we shouldn't be expecting female CEOs to also run their household. And you're exactly right that, when I was in the State Department, a lot of people read my article and said, oh, well, Hillary Clinton could have done a lot more to make it possible for you to do the job. And my response was, no, not at all.
mm-hmm.
She did everything she could, but, we were paid for, the taxpayers paid my salary to begin with. And the job at the State Department depends on the world. And you can't, my line was always, well, you can't say to Egypt, hold the revolution, Andrea will be back on Monday. It just doesn't work that way. And so
right.
I think that's right. We have to understand that there are some jobs, and if you want to have those jobs, then whether you're a man or a woman, you say to your partner or your extended family or whoever is in your life, look, I'm going to be doing this job, and somebody else has to really run the home front. And that's important to understand that there are plenty, there are plenty of jobs that you can make it easier for people to fit their work and their life, together. But there are some that you can't. And
right,
the higher
exactly,
you get,
right.
That's more and more true.
Right. And for the majority of jobs, there can be changes made, and you call for sweeping changes. For our listeners here, some of them are running businesses or working in them and have the ear of the bosses. And so what do you recommend as some of the changes that need to happen in the workplace?
Well, there are many. I mean, I think that what I would say is most helpful for the average business is to adopt a sort of spirit of experimentalism and to focus on the quality and the quantity and the speed of the work rather than the number of hours it takes to produce it. So what I tell individuals is go to your boss and say, you know, I think I could do a better job for you if I, whatever, came in, you know, at noon on one day a week, if I came in, came in later, left early, worked from home one day a week, whatever, you know, everybody has a different set of ways they need to fit things together. But you say to your boss, let's try it, because I think I could do a better job for you. And after 3 months, let's agree on metrics, and if I am, in fact, doing a better job for you, well, then I would like to continue this. And to the bosses, I say, you know, stop focusing on presence and focus on performance and understand that what you care about is not the FaceTime. It is, I asked this person to get this done. I needed it done by this time, and I needed it done at this quality. And that if you let people have the freedom to do that, you'll get better work, they'll be much more loyal, they'll be much happier, that means they'll be more productive. But again, from the boss's point of view, be willing to experiment. Just let go of this notion that, you know, the good worker is the person who comes in early and stays late. That person's often just inefficient.
Right, and you tell a great story about your assistant that you hired who was doing a good job but then left every day at 6 o'clock on the nose, and you're going, wait a minute, I'm still here, you're here to serve me, why are you leaving? And then when you really kind of got into it over time, you saw, my goodness, well, you know, she's actually getting everything done and doing an excellent job, and what's wrong with me that I'm inefficient and I need to stay later?
That's exactly right. I started thinking, how come I'm still here? She's off working out. But, you know, that's, again, the point was exactly that at first I was horrified. I thought, you know, I would have never left before my boss. That's crazy. But then I, started realizing she always got her work done. And surely that was more important to me than her sitting there, you know, between 6 and 7 when, frankly, I should have gone home too, or 7 and 8.
Very good. And I love that you talk about how for many women and for men, that taking care of our children is not just a duty but a desire.
Yes.
And that we really need to change the lens and say this is not a woman's problem. This is not about companies making women's jobs more flexible. This is really a radical recognition that caregiving has value and that humans want to provide for the children in an emotional as well as an economic way. And that's the mothers and the fathers or the caregivers, like myself. I'm an adoptive mother. I adopted a girl when she was 4.
Wow.
So it doesn't need to be biologically determinative that you are the one who gave birth, therefore you're
no,
the one who must
not
give
at
the
all.
Care. It's just like the mother, the father, or the, you know, whoever is standing in as the caregiver, that we need to open the lens and create the space and make it possible for not only women but also, importantly, men to have that side of their lives given expression and support.
Completely, completely. It's a basic side of our humanity, and from an individual point of view, it's important. And from a social point of view, again, I mean, the single most important thing we can do as a society is invest in the education and well-being of our children. I mean, that's our workforce, that's our army, that's our social network for us, the parents. And so I remember so clearly walking down the street. This would now be in 2011. So in 2011, I went home because our eldest son really was having trouble and needed us. And that was a hard decision, but it was driven by, you know, this is my obligation, my responsibility. I brought this child into the world and he's making choices that could affect the rest of his life. This is the right thing for me to do. But then, you know, about a year later, and he was doing fine, and I was thinking, well, you know, if President Obama's reelected in 2012, will I want to go back in early 2013? And I could have tried. And I had this, and I remember thinking to myself, you know, as much as I want to be in that administration, as much as I'd love to be doing another foreign policy job, if I do that, I will miss my children's high school. Right? They will only be in school, they will only be at home for 4 more years, and if I go back in, I will just miss that. The end of my life, I will look back and think, okay, you know, my parenting at home ended in 8th grade. And I thought, I don't want that. And the moment I was allowed myself to say, I don't want that, I felt like a complete traitor. You know, as the feminist in me was like, whoa, I can't say that. No, no, no. You know, I have to say that I care. I put my career first. I am betraying the cause. I am not, you know, a career woman. And I thought, this is crazy. You know, of course this should be something that why is it okay to say I want to be promoted to a high foreign policy position and not okay to say I do not want to miss the last 4 years that my sons, whom I love, and this period of our lives is limited, the last 4 years are going to be at home. What is wrong with a society that says one of those choices is great and the other is somehow lacking?
Right. That's very powerful. And you know, we can think about this now. First of all, it's just right in and of itself that this, as you say, is a very human desire, male and female, of wanting to be close to our children, to our family, before they go off to college in particular. But now we're at a stage where women are living to be, you know, 80, 90, 100 years old. So that window of caregiving to our children, which used to be half of our life. I mean,
yes,
women would give birth as teenagers, and then the life expectancy was maybe 45. So
yes,
you kind of had your children, raised your children, and you died. But
yes,
now,
exactly.
You know, you hit 40, and you have another, you know, 40, 50, or 60 years to go.
Exactly.
So given that, so we should be able to carry on with our professional lives for decades after the children
Absolutely.
Have gone off to college. So
absolutely, and we have time, right? I mean, there's plenty. You know, you can't change the biology, but you certainly can change the career trajectories.
Right, exactly. So how do we get that thing? You say you had the thought, I want to be home, and you felt like you were a traitor, but that is now, really what we need to do is to value the caregiving as much as breadwinning. And
yes.
How do we do that?
Well, there are all sorts of little ways we can do that. So the one thing I say is stop immediately asking people, what do you do? Because what we mean by that is, what do you do for pay? It's our way. It's like Downton Abbey and you know, the aristocracy. What we're doing, we've replaced all that with, who are you in the workforce? How much money do you make? How important are you? What's your title? And that's all that question, what do you do, is aimed at finding out all of that out. And so one of the things, and of course, then when somebody says, I'm home with my children, or I'm doing X and I'm working part-time and I'm caring for my elder, you know, my mother or my father, that immediately lowers that person. And so in our collective social hierarchy. So what I say is, don't ask what do you do. Ask, ask what book have you read, or what are your hobbies, or what did you do last weekend? Ask anything that is not immediately about, what your work is. And then when you find out that someone is, caring for their children, however, in whatever configuration, think to yourself, that's really important. And the same thing goes for somebody who says, I'm a teacher, or a nurse, or a therapist, or a minister. These are all caring professions. They're all investing in other people. And whether you do it for pay or not for pay, we can train ourselves to think, rightly, that's really important. It's important. I as a member of the society, am really glad you are investing in your children because taking care of your parents or a spouse who's ill, because that's the society I will be better. We'll be better off economically and morally and socially. And then there are lots of other ways, which things like, for instance, if Hillary Clinton runs and wins, she's running. If she wins, she'll be 70 when she's president. And you'll be able to look at her career and say, huh, just as you just said, she supported her husband who needed, somebody who was a full-time mother. She was also first lady, but that was part of being first lady, until her daughter went to college, and then she ran for the Senate. And then she was Secretary of State, and then she ran for president. And so that we can literally elongate our expectations so that instead of somebody having dropped out, we think this person is taking time to do an equally important activity, which is caring for those he or she loves, and they are actually growing in the process. And when they're ready, they will, go hard again in the workforce, and we'll be lucky to have them pretty much at any age.
Yeah, you're so right. And the power of our language and what we choose to focus on and becoming conscious of what we value and devalue, we all have a role to play in making this cultural shift. I remember, I came out, I was one of the, I was a graduate of Yale, went to law school. I went into government in the state of Massachusetts, and I was in charge of strategic planning for the state government. I was assistant secretary of state, and then I stepped out, and we adopted a special needs girl, mm-hmm. and it turned out I needed to stay home with her for a while to help her get back on track. I thought it would just be Ad Veronica and keep going, and it was like, whoa,
right.
This
yeah.
is not going to happen.
No.
I family first. I have to take care of my daughter. And then when I would go out and talk to people, I remember I was at a place on a social occasion, and someone asked, what do you do? And I said, well, I'm taking care of my daughter. And
right.
you could just see, you can feel the this person is nothing much. And there was a friend next to me, and she rushed in to kind of rescue me socially. And she said, yeah, but, she's been assistant secretary of state. She was in charge of strategic planning of a $19 billion budget. And she was kind of rushing in to save me. But in that moment, I felt very comfortable that I had made the right choice. There was no question in my mind, family first, and this child would not have made it if I didn't make that full-time commitment to her.
And what does that say about your feedback? Character? I mean, that's a wonder, again, from the social point of view, we want people making those choices. I mean, it's interesting, the place I've seen the most culture change is in the Nordic countries, where now for men, if you don't take paternity leave, you lose it. In other words, your wife doesn't get it or your partner doesn't get it. You either take it or you lose it. And this Finnish CEO said to me that now when he encounters young men who have not taken paternity leave, he wonders about their character. And I thought, yes, that's right. Because if you're a man and you have kids and you have 2 months or 4 months or 6 months, depending on the government, off to take care of those kids, paid, and you don't do it, well, maybe you just shouldn't have had kids.
Yeah, I love what the Nordic countries have done. It's so impressive. And, you know, we really do. I think this is a big piece of it, this what do we value, how do we value it, and, you know, what speaks to character, and what is providing social value. You talk about, you know, so-called human capital. It's like the parents are bringing in the next generation in a practical way. We're expecting and counting on our Social Security. We need the young people out there well-educated and working and earning money to keep that money flowing in.
That's right. Everybody should say, I'm chief people officer.
Yeah, that's it. I'm raising the next generation. What are
right.
you doing?
Yeah, exactly. I'm securing your future.
Right, exactly. I found your entire book engaging with very fresh thinking, lots of great ideas on what to do, and parts of it very deeply moving. But I had a very unusual experience that the part of your book that moved me to tears was your acknowledgments.
Well.
And when I was reading your acknowledgments, I read your story about the woman who had devoted 20 years to raising her child, and she thought she was a failure because she had focused on her family and not work in the world. And I cried because I thought how awful that we as a society undervalue raising a family so much that she would think she's a failure. And how many women feel undervalued or unvalued because they put family first?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I remember that so vividly, and I did. I put her in my acknowledgments because it was a moment that of just extraordinary moral clarity for me. I thought, I mean, this was actually a woman with a special needs child who had done exactly, you know, the right thing. She had put her child first, and it literally came up to me and said, "Thank you for your talk," because I felt like a failure all these years, and I just thought our values are upside down.
Yeah, exactly. And now we think about it, we've got all these women in their late 40s and 50s who still have probably 20 or 30, maybe more. I mean, I have friends who are in their 80s, and they're out there, they're writing books, and they're speaking at conferences,
learning languages,
and they're doing
all sorts of great stuff.
I was like, oh, that's going to be me. I'd love to do that. So these women have another 30 or 40 more years of work, maybe, but once they get off the leadership track, even for a short time, then it's very hard, sometimes impossible, to get back on. So what do you think we can do about helping to get these women back into their careers?
Yeah, you know, so this is a huge issue because this is our biggest underused talent pool. And we read all the time about how the skills shortage, the lack of, you know, the talent wars, that all these companies, you know, can't find the people they want. And I think to myself, you are sitting on this huge pool of very highly educated, talented women who had work experience that, just as you said in your own career, you were Secretary of State, right? And then Assistant Secretary, and you step out, you know, for whatever period of time or work more time, and suddenly you're no longer in that pool. And so, you know, this is, I do study foreign policy. I run an organization devoted to public policy generally. As a policy matter, we have to find ways to tap back into that pool and get those women back into the workforce. And there are a couple things that really seem to be working. One is something that Goldman Sachs started and Morgan Stanley and a number of others are now doing, called returnships. So that it, just like an internship, it's a returnship for people, and they're going to be mostly women who have taken time out, who come back in and get to rotate around in the company to explore what kind of work is being done, just as interns do, to sort of figure out what skills they need. Now, unlike interns, they have a lot of skills. It's just a question of brushing them up or learning new technologies or, you know, taking a course. But that having a way of saying, okay, I'm not going to hire you, I don't know how good you are, but just like with an intern, you bring somebody on and you get a look at them and they get a look at you. There are also a growing number of businesses who are aimed at getting women back in. There's one called, I think it's called Relaunch, and it's the same. These are essentially like life coaches, but who specialize in being the broker for companies looking for talent and women looking to get back in. But I think we could do so much more because, you know, there are lots and lots of women who just aren't sure where to start. And there are lots of companies who just never consider that talent pool and aren't quite sure where to find them.
Yeah, that's good. Well, I think that's important, particularly now, you know, we've got this whole bulging baby boomer population.
Yes.
And, you know, we get so many people hitting into even their 60s now.
Right.
So it's like, I think 60 is going to be the new 40.
I certainly think about it.
About
I mean, I think the same way you
what...
do. You know, my grandmothers lived till they were 90, each of them, and they were born at the turn of the last century, right? They did not exercise. They did not do any of the things that my generation does, and yet they still live to 90. So we all knock wood, we never know what will happen, but even if you just assume I will live the same length of life as my grandmother's, you know, I'm in my late 50s, as you said, I've got 30 years, let's assume, you know, that for at least 20 of those, I am still productive and I may be slower and I may, you know, not work all night, but boy, I have the efficiency, you know, the efficiency born of experience and the judgment and the wisdom, all those things that being in the work, you know, being in any job for a long time give you. And, you know, for the economy and for myself, it seems crazy to not think you're going to be working.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's talk now about the gender bias towards men who
yes.
choose to be the primary caregiver. And you really helped open my eyes some. I never really thought about it, but the ways that men have been trapped by gender expectations and that many men actually do want to be home more with their family, but they feel it's their duty to provide for the family. And I love that you suggest that it's such a deep ingrained in our society that men need to provide for the family. But let's expand what we think providing for the family means, that it's not just providing economically and being out in the job and earning money, but it's providing for the family also emotionally and being present more for the school plays and all the other aspects of raising a child. You talk about that gender bias and that looking in ourselves, that the women saying, well, you know, our husbands really can't handle the housework or child raising, and that we have to be honest and look at that in ourselves if we're going to free both of us, the men and women, from our gender expectations.
That is exactly right. And this was another place where my own thinking just changed. It started because men wrote to me after my Atlantic article and said, you know, you think we have it all, but that's, you know, I would much rather be able to go home at 4 and coach my kids' little league team or simply go to the games, right? I would much rather have a different balance of work and family time. And if I could work part-time, I would do that. And I just never had, it never occurred to me, you know, because that, again, was the way I was raised as a feminist, is men have what everybody wants, which is a career and a family too. But of course, what we weren't recognizing was when we say men have career and a family too, they have a family they don't see that much of. I mean, at least they see them in the morning and at night and on weekends. But what these men were saying is, like, why don't we have the same kinds of choices? Because they pointed out that if they decided to be the primary caregiver, or to work part-time, or even just to take leave, paternity leave, they would be accused of not being committed to their career, just like a woman, but they'd also have their masculinity questioned. And that's when I started thinking, wait a minute, you know, I grew up in a world in which it was unfeminine to be competitive in Virginia in the 60s when I was growing up. You know, girls mm-hmm. were not supposed to beat guys. Girls weren't supposed to beat anybody. That was very masculine behavior. And I thought, well, but I've spent my whole life proving that you can be feminine and competitive. Why is it that men, why can't men be caring, you know, and masculine? Right, and what's the matter with that? And my own husband, who you know, when we got married, we were both young professors. I was ahead of him. I was tenured and he was not, and I just the way it worked out. And then as our lives evolved, I got bigger jobs and he frankly didn't want those jobs. He is much happier with the rhythm of life that gives him more flexibility and time with our children, and I'm the one who, you know, often looks for the next challenge, but he's no less masculine for that. You know, if anything, I think of him as highly competent. You know, he cooks better than I do, and he, you know, can walk into the house and do what needs to be done in the house just as I can walk into an office and do what needs to be done in an office. And both of us, you know, have both sets of skills, but he's the one in the end, who has been happier, and I've been happier with him being what we call the lead parent. So why shouldn't all men have those options?
That's exactly right, and I think that's such an exciting possibility about women and men. You know, figuring out just whatever the couple is, figure out which one wants to do what.
Yes,
and
like
you
two
point
human
out,
beings.
We're human beings, and you point out,
yes,
you know, same-sex couples do this all the time. There are no gender expectations because, you know, you're both either women or you're both men.
Right.
So they figure it out. Maybe that could be a good model for us all, just figure out what makes sense in this partnership, who's going to be doing what, and that may change over time.
Exactly. Exactly.
So you identify the key problem as devaluing and discriminating against caregiving, per se.
Mm-hmm.
It's not against women, so really. It's about this devaluing of the caregiving. So are there any other things you think that we can do that can uplift caregiving? You talked about don't just ask people kind of what do you do, but what are some of the structural changes that can be made in a workplace that value caregiving, and which companies or workplaces do you think are doing a good job with respect for caregiving?
Yeah, I mean, so there are a number of things we can do, again, that just in terms of language, we stop talking, we just erase mothers every time we talk about children or care. We talk about parents, right? We talk about, you know, caregivers. We de-gender those assumptions, which will actually go a long way in our minds to remember, wait a minute, he's a working father just as much as she's a working mother, and they have equal responsibilities. I think the other thing, though, the biggest thing, again, that companies can do is to build in this assumption that all their workers at some point in their working lives, women and men, are likely to have care obligations, and think about extended coverage plans. So, you know, you have people that you manage and you think, well, okay, if so-and-so has to be out on leave, and you're going to assume all so-and-sos will have that at some point in their careers, who would cover for them, and how are we going to do that? And so you build in the rhythms of human life, which, you know, people die, people get sick, children are born, they, you know, need more or less care at different times. But building that into the notion of what a workforce is. The other thing, very specifically, this concept of open work. I'm on the board of Open Work. It's a website and a nonprofit that is just like open source or open government or open open data. It's a new ways of working. So again, this is not about accommodating women who have children. This is about how do we all work differently and more productively given technology and given care. But then the last piece of it that is critical, which is the last part of the book, is we can and should do this individually and as workers and as managers, but we have to do this as citizens. That there is no way, individually or as families or as even as companies, we can support care the way it really must be supported in societies that are smart enough to understand the value of investing in the next generation and taking care of the previous one, it's got to be what I call an infrastructure of care. So just like we have bridges or highways or broadband, that's the infrastructure of competition. We understand that government has to provide that so that all of us can, you know, have jobs and earn incomes and make profits. And similarly, we are going to need, you know, mandates of paid family leave and different ways of supporting child care and elder care. Can be done through tax credits. It can be done through centralized provisions. I think states should try out different things. This isn't a right-left issue. But there's no society that really does support care that doesn't do this as a matter of government policy as much as of individual desire or employers' policies. And we have to decide as citizens that we think this is important. As citizens, we want to say, well, yeah, wait a minute. Investing in the next generation is what a smart country does. And presumably we're not going to ship our kids off to some kind of, you know, massive governmently provided care. We're instead going to make it possible for families to care for each other and have care in lots of different configurations, what I call an infrastructure of care. And again, that goes for elder care as well as child care, and it also, of course, goes for anyone who's disabled or ill, you know, those among us at any time in our lives who need care.
I love that. The infrastructure of care, let's invest in the next generation. We have just 1 minute left. I can't believe this whole hour has gone by. But before you leave, I just want you to tell our listeners just a minute here about what is New America, your think tank and social enterprise. What are you doing now? Where do you intend to lead the organization?
Well, so we've been a think tank, but what a think tank does is it tries to solve public problems, or it tries to help government solve public problems by coming up with, you know, what should we do in education? What should we do in healthcare? What should we do on you know, how to help citizens lead a better life, and all these issues we've been talking about. And what New America does is it does great research and has databases, and we publish fabulous books and articles. But where we're going is to tap into the energy across the country, particularly in smaller cities like Indianapolis and St. Louis or Charlotte or Richmond or lots and lots of smaller cities, where I really see Americans starting to just get things done. They're fed up with waiting for the government, at least the federal government. They're tired of the political infighting, and they are coming together and renewing the country. So where New America is going is to build a national network of hubs in these smaller cities that will essentially tell a story of national renewal and support those people and organizations that are, in fact, once again reinventing who we are and renewing the country.
That's awesome. And that is all the time we have. Dr. Anne Marie Slaughter, thank you so very much for being with us today and for all your important work.
Well, thank you. I couldn't have enjoyed the conversation more.
In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you want to learn more about Breakthrough Solutions, go to thebreakthroughway.com. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give 'Em Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. I'll be back next Thursday. Thanks for joining us. This is Eleanor LeCain with All Together Now.